Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our next session deals with satellite-based augmentation system. It's something that is not unfamiliar to a lot of the rest of the world, but it's something that's very new. But before we start that, I want to just do a little test. How many people in the audience, put your hands up when you've got an answer, how many have still got a paper-based map in their car? Very few. How many of you actually still remember how to read a map? Good. It's very important because today we are so dependent on space-based services. Space-based services have become like water in the tap. You don't ask where it comes from. You just expect them to be there. And when they're not, that's a problem. So as we go across the sweep here, we've got Dr. John Dawson. From Geosciences Australia. John leads the positioning section at GA, so he's got a very strong perspective on SBAS, and I will be asking John to give us a short presentation just to explain what SBAS is all about for those who are uncertain. Then we have Andrew Anderson. Andrew is a general aviation pilot from Sydney, where he's a technology consultant, and for the last decade he's been an active technical participant in Australian Strategic Air Traffic Management. So SBAS is going to be a very important aspect of Andrew's perspective. And we've also got Julia Mitchell, who is a self-confessed space nut. So Julia is working with... who are you working with today?
We're now called Frontier SI. We were
okay,
the CIC
thank you.
For Spatial
thank
Information.
Thank you. Good. Thank you. Julia's got a lot of experience, has worked overseas in the space industry, and understands space deeply. And Alan Smart on the end. We've got Alan here, and Alan has worked and is part of, he's a senior associate of ASIL Allen Consulting. So ASIL Allen, for those in the audience, you know they've done a lot of the core research around Australia into so many different things in terms of agriculture, planning, mining, and making those important economic assessments of how things go. So with that introduction over, what I'd like to do is invite John to give us a presentation now on what is it? What is SBAS?
Thanks, Roger. Thanks for this opportunity to just give a quick overview of what we're about to talk about. My name's John Dawson. I'm from Geoscience Australia. We're one of the lucky agencies because we're responsible for both geology and geography, so we actually do dinosaurs and space. So we're very lucky to do that. But I wanted to just start this off by talking about our sort of vision for this technology, because we're responsible for spatial data. We have a remote sensing program, we have a positioning program, and we have this vision of how we bring these things together. Because spatial data is increasingly important for all citizens. So we have our mapping data, which we all rely on. We spoke about maps just before. And GA is responsible for that. But from a citizen's perspective, there's this move to a digital world where we get information from the private sector, we get information from government, and we bring that together in a visual world. And, of course, this relies on space technology. And, of course, the space technology that I'm interested in is positioning and how we improve the ability to locate our devices and then access this technology. We see it as a broad capability, not only impacting citizens but businesses, and of course agriculture is a clear user of space data, both location data and remote sensing data, and how can we bring that together as a government and provide them with solutions and infrastructure that helps their businesses run better. And that's a key part of our business. But of course government's also responsible for emergency management response and the use of space data to improve the way we respond to emergencies, to the ability to locate people relative to vehicles and keeping them safe is going to be increasingly important. That's going to be underpinned by space technology, and of course positioning is a key part of that. So that's really our vision, and the work that we're doing is attempting to bring that vision together. We all know about GPS, but it's worth just recapping what it is, because we've been We're all users of GPS. Everyone with a mobile phone in their pocket today has a GNSS chip in their hand. But of course, it's not perfect, and a standalone GPS provides that 5 to 10 metre level positioning. It's dominated that limitation is dominated by things like the Earth's atmosphere, the ability to model and manage the clocks that GPS relies on the satellites, but also the ability to determine the orbits of those satellites. Those errors add together and effectively limit the applicability of GPS. But it's not all bad, because over the last 20 years, a whole range of communities have been developing these things called augmentations, where they add ground infrastructure that tracks the GPS constellation and use that ground infrastructure as fixed locations that enable the estimation of the errors that affect the GPS constellation. ESPAS is a type of augmentation. It's an augmentation that was largely developed, was developed for the aviation sector around their requirements, but finds applications in all all industry sectors. And of course, our vision is to actually deploy over the coming years an ESPAS for Australia. We have been funded on the basis that we made the case to government that ESPAS technology was a fundamental technology. It's found, it's been deployed in the Northern Hemisphere, and we felt that Australia was at a significant competitive advantage if we didn't have access to the ESPAS technology. But we're also mindful that we not only want to catch up with the Northern Hemisphere, but there was an opportunity for us to have a look at what's next, what's the next generation of ESPAS, and the work that we've been doing really is exploring the what next part. We 2 years ago now, we were lucky enough to get some funding out of the Department of Industry and the Department of Infrastructure to run a 2-year ESPAS testbed, where we deploy and utilise infrastructure to transmit signals to the Australian continent to enable industry to test and explore that capability in their business areas. And we've worked with a number of partners, Lockheed Martin, Inmarsat GMV, as well as our colleagues in New Zealand government, Land Information New Zealand, and our friends in the CRC for Spatial Information, now Frontier SI, to run almost 30 projects across 10 industry sectors, working with really enthusiastic people from those industry sectors, asking them the question, well, what can you do with this space technology? They came back with a whole range of ideas and really highlighting the opportunities for space infrastructure to really get drive economic benefits and opportunities across those industry sectors. And really on the back of that, the government decided to leverage from those industry sectors, decided to invest in ESPAS technology. To give you a sense for what this technology is providing, certainly in terms of accuracy, it provides sub-metre level accuracy, but we've also tested new technology, PPP, precise point positioning, which has demonstrated sub-10 centimetre level positioning. There are lots of industry sectors that are really eager and keen to be able to apply that technology to their specific application space. Maritime is one particular area where they have a requirement for that 10 centimetre level service to improve efficiency in port operations and improve automation. But in every industry sector that we asked what could you do with this technology, they came back with really interesting and novel ideas of what they could do. So that led up to the budget of the last federal budget, and the government really embraced this idea of investing in position navigation and timing. Of course, Australia may never have its own GPS-like constellation. We're a user of those constellations, but we can certainly do a lot in the augmentation space with smart ground infrastructure, smart analytics, and smart delivery. The government actually funded $64 million to provide improved capability of high precision positioning, the 2 to 3 centimetre, and a further $161 million to develop an ESPAS. They also allocated an ongoing operational budget over the coming 15 years to support these capabilities, reflecting its importance to them. We're endeavouring now at Geoscience Australia to implement this program, and we're endeavouring to keep the test signals on to enable those industry sectors to continue to develop and exploit the technology, and we're working towards an operational SBAS somewhere in the timeframe of 2023. What have we done since the budget announcement? We have entered into a long-term lease arrangement with Inmarsat-4F1, the two navigation transponders. Now we've leased those, and this will serve as a development platform as we move into move from a test mode into a more operational system where we'll need additional satellite capability. We're also in a competitive world. We're competing with the other countries operating SBAS and GNSS, and the satellite numbers are a rare thing, so we're now working towards allocation for Australia of a couple of satellite numbers that will enable complete interoperability with GPS and SBAS technology globally. What does it mean? Well, it means that over the coming years, Australia will join the US, Europe, Russia, India, Japan as an SBAS operator. We'll join Europe and Japan as a country deploying second-generation SBAS technology, and second-generation SBAS technology will exploit not only GPS, it'll exploit the European Galileo, and it'll exploit the two-frequency signals. And we'll become one of the only country other than Japan offering a high-accuracy, open public service, 10-centimetre level positioning capability. And, of course, a key part of our program is around supporting aviation, particularly around the vertical positioning of aircraft. And our program is aiming, and we will support the aviation sector as we move into an operational mode. And that's a very, very quick summary of what SBAS is and what it means.
Thanks very much, John.
So what it means is obviously that the aviation industry is going to benefit, but of course SBAS is also equally important for the forthcoming autonomous vehicle revolution. But certainly the whole concept of automation of driving and the safety and integrity of those systems is going to be hinged on SBAS. And if we don't have any battery stations, at least we'll be able to navigate accurately. One of the things that I did want to ask you, Julia, is perhaps to tell us a bit about the test bed that's been proceeding and maybe a little bit about the actual technology. I mean, where do you get the signals from? How do you correct them, etc.? So tell us a bit about that.
Sure. So we've had testing occur in 10 different industry sectors from going on its way down to Antarctica up to near Papua New Guinea, near Vanuatu, and all the way across Western Australia as well. So we've had testing occur pretty much everywhere you can think of, from at ground level through to up at altitude. We've had planes fly all over Australia and all over New Zealand. So it's been a very impressive geographically testing campaign. Essentially, what a user needs to be able to do is either have an all-in-one unit, such as our mobile phones, which can be SBAS-enabled, but that can be a conversation for another time. But, yeah, you have a receiver and an antenna, and as long as you put the antenna somewhere it can view open sky, you can generally get very, very good results with SBAS. So we have found all kinds of interesting things, like if you do put antennas under lots of leaves in a vineyard, you're not going to get great results, but that's just like trying to get GPS inside, so not unexpected. But we've had some fantastic results, like walking receivers through forestry environments, very heavily forested, and we've got sub 2 metre results. So I think that's pretty impressive. And it's really just showing what the manufacturers can do a lot now, but I think going through in the future we'll get a lot of receivers and antennas that will get smaller, cheaper and higher accuracy results. So you're generally very dependent on what equipment you have at the time when you're using it.
Thanks, Julia. That's very interesting. So were there any other nations involved? Maybe New Zealand? Were they participating?
Oh, yes. Definitely worked very heavily with our New Zealand partners. We had a lot of testing done there from looking at cattle tracking, ideally looking at the application of sheep tracking, because there are many of them over there and they were very interested in that. Apparently sheep really like to give birth at a point where they can see everything, which makes sense. But unfortunately in New Zealand that often means you're near the edge of a cliff, so when you're giving birth the new lamb can fall off the edge of the cliff. Not ideal. So with Espace you can add in a virtual fence to mean that they can't go that far close, they can't go that close to the edge, which is fantastic. But yeah, all kinds of agricultural applications, vineyards, normal horticulture, lots of aviation. And there's some really interesting aviation work, like you can see with the video they've done with the testing.
Thanks, Julie. Now, that's helpful. So what kind of end-user equipment will be required, and how much will it cost for the operational user? Who'd like to answer that question? John.
Actually, a key part of our strategy in this program is to enable high compatibility with the existing services around the world. So we want to be able to exploit existing hardware and chipsets. Mm-hmm. And this program provides a pathway down for very cheap mobile phone level chipsets. So we're quite encouraged that we think that we'll be a mass market capability to pick up this technology.
But they need to be specifically SBAS enabled, is that correct?
They do need to be SBAS enabled, but that increasingly is a common standard around the world.
Oh, that's good to know. So we don't have to reinvent the wheel. That's always helpful. I can't help thinking about those poor sheep on the edge of the cliff. How will other message types be involved here? The DFMC, PPP, how do they affect the L1 aviation signal certification? Who'd like to answer that question?
Yes, thanks, Roger. Yes, well, we've had a couple of things there that are relevant. The first one is a highly successful demonstration. So we've had modified aircraft flying demonstration approaches using the testbed signal, which does contain the extra codes, and we've had no difficulties. So that's a plus. The other great plus we've got is that, like most things in aviation today, the standards are defined by ICAO and regulated in Australia by CASA. The standards in ICAO Annex 10 are performance-based standards. They're not standards for a specific design. And so as a result, our focus needs to be in the certification stage on attaining those performance standards rather than necessarily being concerned about particular message types or how particular transmissions are constructed. So we're in a very, very good place in terms of being able to reach ICAO certification, and a great deal of that, by the way, is due to Geoscience Australia and Frontier SI, who, by enabling the testbed and giving us something to work with, we now find that Australia in the last couple of years in the aviation space has leaped from being way behind to now being at the forefront of what will be possible down the track.
That's really good news. I mean, Australia does a lot of smart things. We have a lot of smart people in this country, but not enough self-confidence to proceed, has been my experience. So how many payloads do you expect to procure? And, you know, will they... how many are required, I guess, for that aviation certification? Do you just get one?
Look,
is one enough?
Generically speaking, for an aviation certified SBAS, there needs to be a high degree of redundancy.
Yep.
That probably means that we'll need at least two payloads, which of course mitigates the risk of one failing and you're without a system. So I think we're working towards a two payload system.
Well, two at least. That's good. I hope we get more. Of course, the big question about that is how much Australian content will be in those payloads.
Look, SBAS is a very mature technology rolled out in the Northern Hemisphere, and at some level we need to take our opportunity is to take advantage of those development costs. So there are elements of the program it makes sense that we use existing technology from around the world. But of course, we will be rolling out infrastructure across the country. There's opportunities for Australian industry. And as I mentioned, the end user opportunities for the Australian space industry to work with those industry sectors, agriculture, transport, integrating the space technology into that broader solution, there's enormous opportunities there.
So it's really, as David Williams said, it's the downstream market. So you take the enabling technology and create more uses for it. So what are the extensive coverage, and what is, the length of the project? How long do you think this project's going to go, and how far will this cover? Will it go out beyond our economic exclusion zone, or how far?
It depends on the service, but the SBAS will be delivered from a geostationary, so we'll have a signal transmitted to a full geostationary footprint, so it'll be quite extensive. The aviation certified component of the signal for use in Australia will be effectively limited to continental Australia and a little bit offshore, but the precision service that will be developed as part of this will be largely valid in the entire footprint, so there's an opportunity for use throughout the region.
So just while you've got the mic there, do you need to have an Earth coverage beam, or can you pipe the signal through spot beams? For instance, our NBN satellites, which is a highly spot beam oriented service.
All existing SBAS services are delivered via
Earth
coverage beam. There may be opportunities for innovative approaches, and as Andrew said, SBAS is a performance-based standard, so there is opportunity for innovation.
Okay, thank you. Are the signals currently being transmitted post the test bed? There is a test bed extension, I understand, that ends on the 31st of July. But what happens after that? Is it something that we hit a cliff edge, or will there be some kind of service to continue on with?
We have extended the current arrangement to the end of July this year, and Australian government through GA is very keen to enable ongoing transmission of some signals, but we're also committed to an open and transparent procurement process where we want to test the market for all operators to have an opportunity to compete for the work. So it's an open question, but our ambition is to try and maintain signals.
Okay, that's good. It would be nice to have continuity in that. And what existing infrastructure will have access to the signals? Is Australian industry ready to utilise that technology? I mean, this is a big question.
I think there's no question that a large part of the benefits to Australia in terms of employment and income are going to be downstream, as David Williams has said. Possibly even 80% of that will be downstream. The big issue, I think, is that there's a bit of a, a gap at the moment between the users and the suppliers, and the level of adoption is to me a critical issue. You can have the productivity impacts, but you get the biggest bang for your buck when you get more adoption. And I haven't got time to go through the levels of adoption across the industry. I mean, at the moment we have 40% of the world's large automated mining machines are in Australia. And so the mining industry in some sectors is a very early adopter, but it's probably not so in agriculture. And one of the issues, if I could use agriculture as an example, one of the issues in agriculture is skills and training and skills and capability. The farmers, the agronomists, the service providers, the consultants do need to get more capabilities in this digital agriculture. Now, fortunately, the rural RDCs in Australia, 11 of them have got together in a program they're calling Precision to Decision. So they're now currently looking at the education and training needs for all of these sectors across the whole supply chain. And I do a lot of work in Tasmania looking at the capabilities there, and there's clearly a need to raise these skills and capabilities. There's a need, for example, I think, for universities to provide more short courses, and the University of Tasmania has just recently made a decision to do that. So it will be those kind of challenges, apart from making the economic case at the enterprise level, that are going to speed up the adoption. And I think that's quite critical to achieving the benefits that we're going to get from space data.
Yeah, that's really important. If we could have a dinosaur sports satellite, I'm sure that we would have all of the venture capitalists coming in to contribute, because there would be people using it. Of course, so that's all to stimulate the STEM component. If you talk to kids, they're always interested in space, they're always interested in dinosaurs, but we need to give them something to inspire them to aspire to doing this work. So what is the education component? What is the STEM component that can be brought out of the SBAS system? Who wants to answer that one? Al.
I can have it first, Craig. I think this is a real challenge. There's been a lot of attempts by, say, the Spatial Industry Business Association and other government agencies to interest kids, for example, into getting into STEM to see where they could apply themselves. Now, the problem in the past is we haven't had a big enough industry to be able to justify that, and the kids can't see how the education path might lead onto a career choice in the future. So at the school level, I think we've got to get those messages across. At the TAFE level and at the university level, I think we need much more integration integration between the digital skills that you need in this sector and the sort of the physics and maths that are currently being delivered. And that, I think, is the real challenge now for all of the education institutions, to focus on how they can target these so that kids can see how they can move through and there is a career there, because they make their decisions on the basis of, you know, can I get a career out of that? And at the moment, I think there's a lot of work to do, and the agricultural one is a really good example of an industry getting together and trying to do something about that. I mean, for example, in Tasmania, to use another example, there are no TAFE courses at the moment in Tasmania that will address this, so these are the real challenges for government.
Thanks, Alan. It's interesting. Many years ago in a different life, somebody asked me at a conference, so how can I make my staff more interesting to you? How can I make them more employable by you? I said, no, you can't, because Australia already produces some of the finest technological educated students in the world. It is that industry component that has to grow, and it's only when you have major programs to stimulate the industry that you will get the investment and you'll get the growth and you'll start to absorb all of these people.